Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
And I'm Tosin Unifowakin.
And we are expecting Dwayne DeFreitas. He's running a little bit late, but he'll be joining us as soon as we start rolling, I'm sure. This week, Google sells Motorola and gets one step closer to Skynet. Netflix and Nintendo aren't going to give up that easily. The Macintosh turns 30. And one more reason to be angry at Angry Birds. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can go to any one of our show notes links on Geeks of Doom, and our iTunes subscription link is in our show notes. Add us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And last week I talked about how I was about to start the process of encoding, of transcoding all of my CDs, the old format, into the new format, which is essentially just storing them onto a hard drive. And I've got like about 400 or 500 CDs that are just sitting on a shelf, not being listened to. And so I've begun this over the last week, encoding those, transcoding them into FLAC files. I have a couple of 3 terabyte drives that I've loaded into a 2-bay NAS server. And so the idea is not just to archive them, but to archive them and have them available as a library that you can access anywhere in the house and listen to whenever you want. So I've started doing that. And the one thing that surprised me that I was not expecting is how long it takes to encode music from CDs to FLAC files. I was expecting that it would, you know, top off at the speed of the drive, which is like about 24 times speed. And I can go through a whole CD in a matter of a couple of minutes. But actually it's sometimes it's like maybe 5 times the speed. And I think that's just the encoding time that it takes to encode from WAVE to FLAC. And so this is going to take a lot longer than I expected. It's going to be an ongoing process for, I would say, a matter of weeks, if not months. So I'm just going to, you know, chip away at it a little bit at a time.
Wow, that's in terms of how long it takes you to do one CD, how long would you say that's been?
I would say one CD is about somewhere more than 5 minutes, but less than 10 minutes. Maybe about 10 minutes max, which doesn't seem like a long time, but you multiply that by 500 or 400 or 500 discs. And that's a good long pastime.
Yeah, that definitely is.
So I've got a lot of encoding to look forward to. But the good news is that I've started the process. The FLAC files are living on this on the NAS drive. I've played the FLAC files out through my Blu-ray player, through my PS3 also, and through my network enabled amplifier, and they play perfectly fine. The process works.
So, yeah, I mean it could be worse, right? You could be using records and try and rip those. So
yes. Now if I had records, I wouldn't even, unless it was a rare record, I wouldn't even bother. I'd go straight to the digital version of whatever record it is, because honestly, I don't think you're going to get any better than the digital encoding, especially if the digital is made from the master that the record was made from.
Right.
How about you, Tosin? What have you been up to recently?
So I have been banging my head away trying to fix some crazy electronic setup. But let me talk specifically about the items that I've been utilizing.
Uh-huh.
I got this Kickstarter called Lightpack. Have you heard of Lightpack at all?
I think we briefly discussed it maybe on the last episode. It's I've heard about something like this, which was a few years ago. Philips had a product called Ambilight, and it was basically if tell me if I'm in the ballpark here. It's essentially like LED lights that are affixed to the back of your display, and they sync to what's going on the screen so that it creates this ambient light that bounces off your wall that matches in a way what is going on the screen.
Exactly. So that's precisely how you describe it. And it's really supposed to, create that sort of ambience and atmosphere with what you're watching, and actually also supposed to be easier on your eyes, as you're not just focusing on a smaller area. It kind of really expands the zone of what you're watching. Now the light pack specifically is made for a computer, as it plugs in via USB and has software that runs on the OS to detect what the colors are in the various aspects of your screen.
Mm-hmm.
But as the sort of technophile that I am, I realized that, you know what, I don't use my computer screen as much for watching things. I typically use my TV. So I was sort of curious if there was a way that I could get it to stream content specifically from my PlayStation, as well as, you know, maybe my Xbox or Chromecast, to my TV and have it work there. So I ended up battling with it throughout the weekend with a few different crazy configurations using, you know, composite cables and all sorts of ridiculousness. But I finally settled on a solution that seems to work for all my devices, and that's using another device I've been playing with, the Elgato Game Capture HD. So what this actually does is it provides you the ability to record what's going on from, you know, any of your game consoles, and even from, you know, Apple iPad devices, things of that nature, anything that you can connect via HDMI.
Uh-huh.
To your computer, and comes with a pretty nifty software. It's actually this really small box, and it's really compact and very sleek looking, and it works flawlessly. The resolution it can capture is really high and quality. It connects to your computer via USB, but allows basically HDMI pass through back to your TV. There's pretty little to no lag utilizing it for the capture, and also provides a lot of built-in features so that you can actually do live Twitch TV streams, as well as upload to directly to YouTube and other channels just from that software. Now, if you want to do any more in-depth editing, it does provide a lightweight editor, but if you want to do any in-depth editing, you probably will want to you probably want to take the video, export the video out, and use different software like Sony Vegas to do that, Adobe Premiere. The one caveat I will make for those who are actually interested in getting themselves one of these devices is the device is not made to bypass HDCP. So what HDCP is basically an encryption model that I believe if Sony put into place in a later revision of HDMI to really protect people from ripping high definition streams from via HDMI, be it primarily they were looking to stop people from being able to easily rip movies or rip Blu-rays with their computers. But this, of course, provided an issue with consumers, because what it also meant is trying to, given that things were encrypted in this sort of handshake mechanism, with, for example, the PS4 or the Xbox One, you now could no longer capture games because games were coming through HDMI and it would be get blocked. So Microsoft and Sony have said this month that they are going to be putting a patch out so that HDCP will not be going will not be sent when you are playing. The handshake will not be required when you're playing a game, so that you can go ahead and record
Oh,
that.
that's awesome.
So that is a change that is coming down the line. Now, HDCP has been cracked several times over. So what a lot of people are doing instead is they get a HDMI splitter that basically removes HDCP, and from there they can utilize their game capture. I actually have one as well, and that's really because I need to mirror both what I watch from Blu-rays and Netflix on my computer so I can get the colors for my screen. But anyway, it works pretty flawlessly. It's kind of cool to see. By the way, the capture device is around $150 currently on Amazon Prime, and the light pack, you'll have to check out lightpack.tv to see when it goes on sale from their Kickstarter. It's a pretty cool device. Still needs a bit of work, but having fun playing with it.
Wasn't the whole idea of this is kind of off topic, but wasn't the whole idea behind like one of the selling points to the Xbox One and the PS4 was the ability to socially share video captures of your gameplay?
Yeah, that's a big part, and that's part of the targeting marketing. Now, the way that the PlayStation currently gets around this sort of stuff is it allows you to share directly from that device, meaning you don't have to do any of this external manipulation where you actually get it on your computer and toss it
And
up.
have to
But I
edit
mean,
it or whatever.
I can see a lot of people using that, but I can also see a large drive towards wanting to capture it on your own. And because at that point you have more freedom in terms of how you edit it, what your voiceover is, and really putting your own sort of branding and marketing around your gameplay footage. Oh, one last really nifty thing that I realized that the Elgato can do is it gives you the ability to, it actually sort of has a cache, so that if you don't start recording in time, you can actually start you can start recording and capture the footage that happened, minutes or I'm not sure what the time period frame is, but it may be like 5 minutes before you even push that record
Like a
button.
buffer, like a video buffer that is always is continuously recording, and then you just hit save when you want to save that section that you've been buffering.
Right.
Awesome. That's cool.
Yeah.
I think I have a I think I have an iPhone app that records video that way too. Yeah, that's a really neat feature. I wish a lot of other because you never know some you never know what you're gonna want to see until. Sometimes it's already passed. So
Right.
it's great to have that ability to catch it after the fact. Another thing I wanted to mention is that you and I both saw the movie Her, which is the Spike Jonze film starring Joaquin Phoenix and the voice of Scarlett Johansson.
Yeah, no, I saw that last night, and man, what an excellent film. And there's just so much contained within it that I'm keeping this sort of spoiler free, but one of the things that I most remarked about this film is just the way that Joaquin Phoenix is really able to portray emotions and kind of be like a one-man show for a good chunk of the film. He
Oh,
made it
yeah.
seem it was so believable. It was really realistic. And I truly enjoyed it. The other really interesting aspect of this film, and I'm not sure if you knew this, but Scarlett Johansson was hired post-production, so they actually had a different voice, and they decided to bring her in and replace the voice, all post-production, which is
I
pretty
did hear about
remarkable.
that. It was originally Samantha Morton, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I believe
Uh,
so.
and uh, and it, what an incredible performance. You would never guess that the two did not record their parts at the same time or within vicinity of each other, because Scarlett Johansson is just so effortless in her reacting to Joaquin Phoenix. But just briefly, what this movie is about and why it's why I think it's a particular interest on this show is it's about a guy who falls in love with his operating system, which is essentially an artificial intelligence. And it takes the form of a female voice, and he has a deep, meaningful relationship with this female voice. And I felt that this movie was really prescient. It takes place in the near future. And I thought it was really prescient about how our relationships and our relationship with technology will be shaped in the near future. It feels very realistic, like how our relationship with technology will actually go down when it finally does, when we do interface with artificial intelligence. I don't know if you got the same feeling when you saw this movie.
Yeah, no, I think this was pretty amazing and gave really quite the perspective and made me think a little bit twice about, you know, how we interact with voice, with our current voice systems, because I'm one of those people who use Siri all the time for everything. Text messages, checking, you know, directions, all sorts of things all day long. And it was one of the most telling facts is after we were done with the movie, went with a group of people, uh-huh. We decided that, hey, we should go get food. And then one of our friends is trying to give us directions to where this place is. And we all just were like, hey, Siri, give me directions to that. And then someone was like, okay, Google, give me directions to that. And so it's like, you know, we'd seen the movie and we were still satisfied to be able to still have that sort of interaction. Uh-huh. And I definitely think that, you know, 5-10 years down the road, you're going to see a lot more coupled. You're going to see a lot more coupled relationships in terms of how people address and work with the voice in the box. I think you're not going to see it just in your phones, but in the doctor's office. You know, we have the intellectual with IBM's Watson, which, you know, may not at this juncture have a completely Siri-like voice, but that's just a little improvement that has to be added there. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it sort of develops, and I would not be surprised if, you know, someone on the internet starts, going down that path of, hey, I've automated my entire lifestyle, the self of things, and now I sort of have this companion, so to speak.
Well, this is going to tie in really well into what we'll be talking about a little bit later on in the show, which is Google's purchase of an AI company. But I think we're headed in that direction. I think, you know, all of the, you know, we've firmly established that everything is going mobile. We want to take everything with us. And as such, Siri and the Android equivalent have been a really helpful part of our relationship with our current mobile phones. And I think all of these companies are seeking to improve that relationship, to make better technology, more intuitive technology for us. And as such, we will see advancements in artificial intelligence. And who knows, this could very well be possible. But I thought it was interesting that, you know, we almost take it for granted. I bet you know, if you notice, if you pulled yourself away from the screen of your mobile phone and looked at people walking down the street, you'll see, like was demonstrated in this movie, most everybody involved in their own technology as well, like staring at their phones or listening to their, you know, their music on their MP3 players. And so we've already sort of established that we're becoming more intimate with our technology in a way that excludes human interaction at this point, everyday human interaction. We you know, we'll be more involved with our personal devices than we will with people walking down the street these days. And I think that's a very telling sort of place to start, where it's easy to see the world of Her extrapolated from that point.
Yeah, I think it's kind of interesting, and it really shows this sort of change in the direction where I guess society is heading. And taking a step back, you know, in Her, we're talking, the part which we're focusing on right now is that relationship, but it doesn't have to be a sort of like a, you know, a dating relationship, or it can be more of like a friendship, sort of like Iron Man and Jarvis, right?
Yeah, that's
I mean, that's typically the ideal that every little kid wants to have. I want my own Jarvis. But this reminds me, what you were saying really reminds me of there's a short film, I believe it's called I Forgot My Phone, which have you seen it at all?
No, I haven't heard of this.
I'll send you a link.
Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes.
It really shows how everyone is really kind of obsessed in their technology, head down, and you notice it everywhere when you just take that step back to look up and look around. And I think that's what this one individual does within that sort of short film. I guess the one thing is we just have to make sure Terminator doesn't come about. That's really, I was waiting for Terminator in that movie. I was just like,
a little hint of it there. No spoilers, but there's a little hint of a potential sort of Skynet future.
Yeah.
So, I absolutely love that movie. I hope it wins some sort of Oscar.
Yeah, year. I would have to it's say sort of so far out of the movies I've seen, and I have not seen 12 Years a Slave. I haven't seen all the big films, but so far it's probably my favorite. Or the best film I've seen for 2013.
Yeah, it's excellent. It's excellent. Okay, so let's jump into some headlines here. Last week we talked about the Ohio Google Glassware who was pulled out of a screening of Jack Ryan's Shadow Recruit and detained at his local AMC theater by a member of Homeland Security. TechCrunch recently spoke with this glass wearer, who is a programmer and a Balkan native who wishes not to be named. He's keeping his privacy. And I just wanted to read a couple of quotes from the interview that they had from him in TechCrunch. So TechCrunch asked him, "So now what? Are you angry? What do you want people to understand about your experience?" And he said, "As any new technology is expected, people don't understand it quickly. Many have advised me to sue AMC and or Department of Homeland Security. I'm not planning to do that. I would love to have the chance to talk to the management of AMC, Regal, or any other movie theater chains and show them what glass is and what it isn't. As people take their camera phones in the theater and turn them off, people should turn off glass in the theater should they choose to bring it in. And in time, as this product will be known better, people will freak out less. It's just a matter of a learning curve." I thought this was a very, very pragmatic response to this. I mean, this is a guy who understands being on the bleeding edge of technology and understands the public reaction to something like this and can see, like, the road ahead. Can see, because we've all been there. We've all seen that new technology in one way or the other. I remember, for me, going way back when video recorders first came out, and the studios were all up in arms because they were going to be losing revenue from people taping movies that were playing on TV. Movies that were playing on TV and having those movies on their shelves without any money changing hands for the studios. And they, in fact, they sued, I believe it was Sony that they sued amongst other video VHS manufacturers. And in time, all of that sort of moral panic went away because people realized, well, it's not nearly as good as, you know, you could tape it off a TV. You could, you know, record video in a theater wearing Google Glass, but who would really want to watch that copy? It's just not worth the effort, you know. Right.
There are more than other ways of people distributing it or even getting the content that are, you know, probably the methods they should tackle. I think there are a couple real keys to this article. One of the things that I didn't realize before was that he actually had prescription Google Glass, so he mm-hmm. actually had it tied to his prescription. And
that's
and
this why time, he couldn't.
Right, exactly, and that's why he actually wore it in the theaters, and he forgot. He typically wow. doesn't wear it to the theaters, but you know, he made a mistake. He's done it before, and it came up. I think the big thing that a lot of people are talking about is, why was it Department of Homeland Security called into yes. this? Like, you would think that they would have bigger fish to fry and other things to do rather than, like, you know, at first I thought it was like, okay, this is just the quote unquote mall cops or local authorities who also should have better yeah. things to do. But to escalate it to such a high level, and at such a high level, not to be trained with the sort of technology around like that, I think that's kind of unacceptable.
I think the reason is in a really sort of roundabout way is the Department of Homeland Security runs the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and the Customs Enforcement part of that division runs the sort of the copyright infringement department.
Meaning that they're also sort of tied to the movie industry? Like, I mean, that seems like a bad place to be in,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
this is like, I don't want to compare this to the NSA, but this is kind of, you are accidentally sleeping in the same bed as a major power. And yeah. this is also what I've complained about several times in terms of things like net neutrality, etc.
Right, so. Right, right, right. What scares me about that relationship is that basically what they're saying is that since Department of Homeland Security can define and prosecute terrorists, the studios who are working with ICE, with the Customs Enforcement Department, can define people who tape video, you know, record movies in theaters as economic terrorists, and they'll be treated on the same footing as people who blow up public buildings, when it's clearly not, you know, not nearly as heinous a crime.
Yeah, it reminds me of IT Crowd making fun of piracy.
Right. At the beginning. yeah. You wouldn't steal a car, would you? That was the original video.
Yes.
And theirs went even further than that.
Right.
once again, one more quote from this guy. TechCrunch asked, "What's next for you and Glass? Where do you go from here?" And he said, "Next, it's only more efforts to educate people about technology. I'll keep wearing glass all the time, maybe except at the movies. And as always, if anyone asks me about glass, I will let them try it on and give a little demonstration of the capabilities. I signed up for glass, but I guess I also signed up for being harassed by authorities that are unfamiliar with technology. Some hiccups are to be expected with any new advancement. When I first talked about this, I thought I would accomplish two things. First, glass users won't be as ignorant as I was when going to the movies. And second, it would inspire people to educate the authorities more in regards to technology. Glass users cannot record you without your knowledge, even if they would want to. The little prism in front of glass lights up when glass is active. And by active, I mean showing an email to the user, showing a text, taking a picture or video, or whatever glass does. So, in other words, it's easy to see when glass is recording." At least until there's a workaround around that.
I mean, that's clearly the case. But, you know, the one thing I will say is, you know, props to this guy, because
Yeah.
he sounds like he, you know, is very critical and very sort of aware. And
Yeah.
so.
Very, very sort of realistic about the reaction going out into the world wearing this unusual piece of technology. Moving on. So last week we touched upon recent changes to net neutrality that could potentially open the rules of the internet up to influence by corporations, namely ISPs. And this week Netflix spoke out in a letter to their shareholders. They said, unfortunately, Verizon successfully challenged the U.S. net neutrality rules. In principle, a domestic ISP now can legally impede the video streams that members request from Netflix, degrading the experience we jointly provide. In a worst-case scenario, Netflix imagines a situation in which it would have to pay fees to ISPs to stop that degradation. But it sounds like the company wouldn't just sit back and let that situation happen. They go on to say, were this draconian situation to unfold with some ISP, we would vigorously protest and encourage our members to demand the open internet they are paying their ISP to deliver. So clearly, Netflix feels the threat placed upon them by the by losing this case and having the rules of net neutrality change. And they are taking it right to the their shareholders, and to the public, I would imagine in the future if it should get to that point.
No, I mean that's exactly right, and I applaud Netflix for standing up for themselves and not just taking it down, because this would potentially directly influence their business, and you know cause some instability in terms of their shareholder price. But
Yeah.
it's you know I think they will find themselves with a lot of backers and a lot of people behind them. It's also kind of interesting that they believe that the ISPs won't take such stances. It's as if Netflix believes that it actually has the power to make sure that this doesn't come about. And so that's pretty impressive, because say this was 2 years ago, Netflix definitely would not. I don't think
Right.
Netflix would even consider saying something like this,
They'd roll right
consider
over.
potentially shaking the pillars.
Yeah,
Because,
yeah,
of
yeah.
course, when you think about the ISPs who have won, the ISPs are directly connected to the same sort of industries that Netflix needs to get the content from. So, pretty awesome. Glad Netflix is doing it. Fight the good fight. We need someone on our side when it comes to net
Yeah.
neutrality.
Absolutely. You know, 'cause this hits them directly in their pocketbooks. And I would imagine, like, as a Netflix customer who absolutely adores the service, I will fight tooth and nail to prevent Netflix from raising the subscription fees in order to counteract the whatever they would be charged by the ISPs because of this the net neutrality change.
Yeah. I mean, that's not to say Netflix is not going to raise their prices,
No, sure.
because but directly as a
Right,
result of this, I
right.
don't want to see any sort of service have to bow down.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay, so moving on here. In new news, the National Security Agency and its UK counterpart GCHQ have been developing capabilities to take advantage of quote unquote leaky smartphone apps such as the wildly popular Angry Birds game that transmits users' private information across the internet, according to top secret documents provided to The Guardian by whistleblower Edward Snowden and reported in partnership with the New York Times and ProPublica. The data pouring onto communication networks from the new generation of iPhone and Android apps ranges from phone model and screen size to personal details such as age, gender, and location. Some apps, the documents state, can share users' most sensitive information such as sexual orientation. One app recorded in the material even sends specific sexual preferences, such as whether or not the user may be a swinger. So scooping up the information the apps are sending about their users allows the agencies to collect large quantities of mobile phone data from their existing mass surveillance tools, rather than solely from hacking individual mobile handsets. So, first of all, I think this is a wake-up call to any of the companies that are making apps that are quote-unquote leaky. It's time to shore up those leaks and tie up all the loose ends, because nobody wants their personal information leaking out. And nobody thinks about mobile phone apps. You know, we all think about personal computers and mobile phones in general, the operating system on mobile phones. But nobody really thinks too hard about the security of personal information coming from phone apps, because it's something we take for granted and I think we use on a regular basis.
Often when it comes to the mobile market, sometimes for organizations, they think it's, you know, it's better to be, as they say, it's better to be first to market, which is not necessarily the case. But, you know, often organizations will just leap to get their product out and won't really take the time to shore up the security around it until much further into their organization's, you know, life cycle.
Right.
And I hope that sort of that mantra changes, because as you can see, you know, sometimes it's easy to say, hey, we'll do this much later, when you're just as easily compromising, you know, the same people who love your product. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think this is really going to affect Angry Birds that much. Mm-hmm. But it's going to at least it'll make people think twice, right? At least having this information out there will make people, be it the developers making these games or you know, pieces of software, or the people who go ahead and download it.
I'm looking at the article that you sent over, and apparently two Norwegian politicians have submitted Edward Snowden as a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
On going from a wanted list to now nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Question is, can, you know, if he were to win one, would he be able to collect it without getting extradited to the United States?
Right. All right. Moving on here, let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week in honor of the 30th anniversary of the Macintosh is I Was, How I Invented the Personal Computer and Had Fun Along the Way by Steve Wozniak. Before cell phones that fit in the palm of your hand and slim laptops that fit snugly into briefcases, computers were like strange alien vending machines. They had cryptic switches, punch cards, and pages of encoded output. But in 1975, a young engineering wizard named Steve Wozniak had an idea. What if you combine computer circuitry with a regular typewriter, keyboard, and a video screen? The result was the first true personal computer, the Apple I, a widely affordable machine that anyone could understand and figure out how to use. From the invention of the first personal computer to the rise of Apple as an industry giant, iWAS presents a no-holds-barred, rollicking first-hand account of the humanist inventor who ignited the computer revolution. And I've read this book, and it's great. It's great to hear Woz's own voice. It's not his own voice reading the audiobook, but you feel his voice coming through the text. And to hear his own personality that everybody knows and loves Steve Wozniak. And to hear that bubbly personality coming through, telling the story of the genesis of the Apple, the first true personal computer, and as Apple Computer as a company itself, to hear all that in his words is really a delight. Have you read this book?
I have not. It sounds like something that would be up my alley, given that in Silicon Valley and the Computer History Museum, which I've gotten the chance to go to, has all that sort of history, and I know they were setting up a maybe recent event where Woz and a bunch of other people are going to be there.
Well, if you want to download that free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook, or any one of Audible's 100,000 plus titles, plus the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. We're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, Google puts Motorola in their past and artificial intelligence in their future. Take a listen to this and come on back.
I certainly haven't been shopping for any new shoes. And I certainly haven't been spreading myself around. I still only travel by foot, and by foot it's a slow climb. But I'm good at being uncomfortable, so I can't stop changing all the time. I notice that my opponent is always on the go. And won't go slow, so's not to focus. And I notice he'll let you ride with any guide as long as they go fast from whence he came. But he's no good at being uncomfortable, so he can't stop staying exactly the same. If there was a better way to go, then it would find me. I can't help it, the road just rolls out behind me. Be kind to me, are treating me mean. I'll make the most of it, I'm an extraordinary machine. If there was a better way to go, then it would find me. I can't help it, the road just rolls out behind me. Be kind to me, are treating me mean. I'll make the most of it, I'm an extraordinary machine.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Tosa Nanafwakan, and now we're joined also by Dwayne DeFreitas. How you doing, Dwayne?
Hey, guys. I'm in good shape. How you doing?
Good, good, good. Glad to have you for the second half of the show here. An anonymous source claims that Nintendo, which, as we all know, has been reeling after an absolutely disastrous year, is working on the successor to the much-maligned Wii U, called the Nintendo Fusion. It's a collective name for Nintendo's next generation of both home and portable consoles. And while news that Nintendo isn't just watching its money evaporate is not in itself remarkable, it's noteworthy that there are actual possible specs for the hardware. The specs for the hardware has been printed over at the Escapist magazine, and they have specs for both the home console and the DS, the potential DS dual screen system.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing here is that Nintendo, they have, now they have access to the hardware being distributed by Microsoft and Sony with the Xbox One and the Sony PlayStation 4 respectively. They have the ability to jump in now and say, hey, look, this is what I'm going to offer with my awesome software and actually compete with these guys. It's also playing it safe to their own detriment.
They could have the access to the hardware if they want to. I feel like it's a cultural, it's a choice culturally not to pursue the cutting edge. And yes, it has been to their detriment. And I think they went that route for a couple of generations of game consoles now, and now they've had that come to Jesus moment where they realize it just doesn't work, that they're getting the pants beat off of them by Sony and Microsoft, and now they have to quickly sort of pivot and change directions and now chase the big boys.
Yeah, no, I mean it's pretty interesting to see this change in Nintendo's mantra, and kind of refreshing to know that they are willing to change so that they can, you know, at least have a fighting chance in this generation. Also, pretty remarkable to note that they are that you know, assuming this rumor is true, they're looking to launch a new console a lot sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
Right. While you know Sony and Microsoft are sort of in this for the long haul, so to speak. They believe that this console is going to last them a very, very long time. So this is pretty cool. I think it's going to really be. It's competition is always good, and for the Nintendo fans out there, this is quite refreshing to know that, hey, this company still cares more than just about handheld stuff, still cares to really be competitive in this marketplace.
But how are you going to feel as a owner of a Nintendo Wii U that, you know, essentially the company is abandoning the device that you just bought for something new?
Well, I mean, as a Nintendo fans are always in it for the long haul. So I think that I don't see them being as upset as, say, if it was like a Sony or Microsoft fan. Now, maybe that's my delusion here, but I sort of have a feeling that given the way Nintendo positions itself and sort of the fan base positions themselves, as long as the Wii U still has quality games represented with it, and who knows, maybe there could be some sort of backwards compatibility. I think they may not be as disappointed as, or at least the outcry may not be as large as be it another of those other organizations.
Yeah, I don't know. I would feel pretty cheesed off if I just bought a Wii U to hear that Nintendo's going to be, you know, focusing all their efforts on the next thing to come out.
I know. What's the compatibility going to be? I mean, we've already seen multiple game manufacturers say that they're not going to be supporting the Wii U.
Yeah.
If they're going to be supporting this new Nintendo device, the Wii U is basically a Sega, you know, Dreamcast.
Exactly. It's a lame duck.
It's no supported devices on reasonable hardware. But the fact is, Nintendo asked for this. They could have waited. Everybody knows that the Wii was a device that people were like, okay, it is what it is. We understand it now. It's been 7 years. We respect what the Wii is. And Nintendo could have waited to see what happened after Microsoft and Sony came out with their respective devices and then chased that down. Instead, they were like, we're going to go for short-term financial gain with this Wii U. And like you said, Andy, I think it's a cultural problem. This sort of insular... Actually, I don't think it's cultural. I think it's cultural in terms of Nintendo, not Japan, because Sony is thinking of the big picture, whereas Nintendo is, you know, has always focused on this really small picture, this is the way we do things situation, and it's kind of messy.
It's odd that, isn't it, that Nintendo has had that sort of, like, insular mind think that they don't really listen to the public at large, but they have their own heartbeat that they listen to, but it doesn't always work in their favor.
It's a mess, and they really need to, like, I know their mentor's gone and they have to figure out how to do things without him, but they really need to think about themselves as a technology company, not just a gaming company. If they do so, they're going to end up in a place where all they provide is software and not hardware, and hardware is where the money is.
The specs on these look good, I must say. That some of the stuff that they're talking about in the Fusion DS, they're talking about two motorized circle pads for haptic feedback, which sounds exactly like the Valve. The first generation of the Valve controller.
It sounds like a gamer system instead of just a consumer system.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's they're focusing back on gamers. Which is what Nintendo has to do, because the Wii was a sort of like, well, hardcore gamers can go to the other guys, but we're here for the experience. And I think the Wii, this new device, I don't know what's going to be named when it actually comes out, but this new device sounds like something that, like, gamers can actually chase down and put on their entertainment systems and be happy with.
Yeah. Some of these specs, in fact, seem a bit overkill.
It's got to last for 7 years.
Yeah. A holographic enhanced card slot. on the DS. And on the terminal, they're going to have a cable card slot, which is interesting, which means that you'll be able to that they're thinking for the first time ever, Nintendo is thinking of having their
being
unit
your being, only box, yeah.
Being a set-top box.
Yeah.
That's
so
new.
I haven't experienced good cable card integration outside of New York. Have you guys?
No. I have to say that I haven't really used it. You know, we have a dedicated cable box, so.
Yeah, I haven't used a cable card in years.
I feel like it was a big thing in the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, whatever you want to call it. And then it fell to obscurity because the cable companies wanted their own hardware because DVRs became a big deal.
Well, then Nintendo is following suit in tradition in including a near obsolete technology. Yeah. Okay, so moving on here, big news of the week, one of the two big Google stories. Recode reported that Google is shelling out $400 million to buy a secretive artificial intelligence company called DeepMind. Based in London, DeepMind was founded by games prodigy and neuroscientist Demis Hassabis along with Shane Legg and Mustafa Suleiman. It's in large part an artificial intelligence talent acquisition. According to online bios, Hassabis in particular is quite a talent, a child prodigy in chess who is later called, quote, probably the best games player in history. Though DeepMind may not be a household name in tech, sources in the AI community describe the company as a formidable AI player and says it's been aggressively recruiting in the space. They've got a team of at least 50 people and secured more than $50 million in funding. Someone described DeepMind as the last large independent company with a strong focus on artificial intelligence, and it is said to have competed with companies like Google, Facebook, and Baidu for talent. So now Google has them. And, you know, when Google first bought those first seven robotics companies...
Well, let's differentiate before you go on.
Okay.
They bought robotics companies. This is an AI company.
Yes.
There's a difference here. Robotics means using a computer to move machinery. AI is the differentiation. It is having a computer make decisions. Like artificial intelligence, AI, is what it's really focused on. And that's the kind of thing that I think begins to tie together Google's recent robotics purchases.
Well,
that makes some sense.
That's what I was leading to, is that, you know, when they first bought those first seven companies, I was like, okay, so what are they up to? And then when they bought Boston Dynamics, I thought, okay, so what are they up to now? And now that they've bought this company that is an AI, the leader in the AI space, essentially potentially the brains behind whatever they create in the robotic space, the first thing I thought of was, okay, no, seriously, now what the fuck are they up to?
Well, I mean, it's clear they want a smart automation platform. They're going to build that with this code base. They're going to have some technologies already available, and they're going to make it so that third parties can jump in and truly make an Android. When I say Android, I don't mean like their branded phone OS term, but truly make an Android-based situation. That's what Google does. They go out and they acquire the businesses that allow them to move forward and create new markets and better markets, right? Like they went out and they got SketchUp. And once they got SketchUp, they had a better mapping system, Google Earth. Google focuses on that. They excel at that. They excel at looking at what's out there and making it better. I think they're becoming mature enough to see emerging markets, especially in robotics, et cetera.
Yeah.
And to chase that down, so I'm pretty excited about what they're thinking about with this DeepMind situation, and using it as the code base to integrate the seven robotics companies that they recently acquired.
Yeah, I mean that's a very well thought out move. Most likely they saw the movie Her, and then they thought, you know, why can't we do?
No, I think it happened. I think the negotiations happened before Her. But if you listen to NPR and that discussion with River Phoenix, you realize that Her was a complete fiction because River Phoenix is nuts.
Oh, Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin Phoenix. I'm sorry, River Phoenix is dead. Rest his soul.
But you know, I have to say that, like, doesn't it concern anybody that that they could actually be that? You know, this is the paranoid tinfoil hat wearer speaking, but like state of the art robotics, like Petman combined or Atlas combined with state of the art artificial intelligence, it can only spell disaster for the human race.
Well, that's far after we're dead, hopefully, so it's okay. Bottom line is, the enhancements of the human race, like, okay, we've all seen the films, we've all seen the movies,
yes,
we've all read the books that have laid out the destruction of the human race at the hands of its enslaved robots. The vast majority of our recorded history involves slave humans, and those slave humans could not effectively revolt. They just couldn't. There's like a couple cases. There's one in Guyana with Kofi. There's one in Haiti. And maybe there's one with Spartacus. But for the most part, slaves do not effectively revolt against slave masters. Now, robots are a type of slave, no doubt. Mm-hmm. Should they become aware, I mean, if we decide to follow Asimov, which I think Google is interested in doing, I'm just throwing that out there. I don't know if they're actually working on that or whatever. Asimov protects us. Google has been looking at Star Trek as its model.
Yeah.
And the fact is, Star Trek is completely based off Asimov. So I don't think that we're in a place where Google's making death machines for the human race.
At least
they're
not
making Cylons. Yeah, they're not. There's no Cylons here. I think Google's just thinking about how can we better help our users' lives by automating and manufacturing devices that help us make our lives easier. You want to do less homework. You want to go to work. You want to come home, and you want to be able to not worry about cleaning your floors or cleaning your or thinking about smoke detection or like your humidifier or your thermostat. You want to just think about what you want to do creatively or physically. Like, I'm going to go running. I'm going to go on the treadmill. I'm going to go do whatever, pump iron, whatever. And I think Google has the potential now with these companies to kind of make all that other stuff go away. It should just go away. It should all be appliances. And that's great. I think that's exciting.
I know at the very least now with these recent purchases that a company like Apple has to be a little concerned about their position as market leader.
I think Apple is looking at the other thing we're going to speak about with regard to Google and become very concerned. The fact is, Google bought Nest.
Yep.
And they saw $3.2 billion. And like, okay, we're going to get rid of something. And that's something they got rid of was Motorola.
Yep. So,
and that's the story we're going to talk about next, I feel like. Yep. And that is where Apple gets concerned, because Apple has created this Apple TV. There's some rumor that they might have a television set. But the fact is, they're not in your home the way Google can now be positioned to be in your home. Mm-hmm. And with Google's money behind Nest, the Nest devices can come down in price significantly, so that the average user will say, you know what, the convenience is worth any concern I have about my whereabouts, my privacy, whatever. If I can spend $100 on a thermostat, which is where that device will come down to with Google's bankroll, then it's worth me getting $400 in heating savings later. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge thing. The Nest Protect which will become the Nest Connect, I'm sure, that can tell where you are in your house and can then talk to the thermostat and help you out. These are things that are like exactly what the quantified self person wants. This idea that, like, you know where I am, you know what I'm doing, and you know what I'm up to, and you can optimize my situation for that. Honeywell is moving toward this thing too, but they're a little slower. So Google by buying Nest is very helpful, and the fact that they can, their balance sheet is in good shape because they got rid of Motorola, which, let's face it, the Moto X was well touted but a middling phone at best, allows Google to move in a way that Apple is concerned about.
Sure, sure. So before we bury the lead, Lenovo is buying Motorola Mobility from Google. Google purchased that company just recently in 2011 at $12.5 billion, and now it's going to go to Lenovo for $2.91 billion. That's quite a markdown on that.
So, well, yes and no. I have a feeling that the sale to Lenovo includes the ability to rely on every single patent Motorola has ever built.
Right? According to the article that I'm reading here, Google will maintain ownership of the vast majority of the Motorola Mobility patent portfolio.
Exactly. So this is what makes it viable. They wanted those patents to protect themselves against Apple, Palm, whomever. But the actual company as itself, they don't need that company to move forward. The Nexus 5 is a fantastic phone. It's wonderful. And it had no involvement with Motorola. So, and they've got the Samsung Galaxy S4 Google Edition or whatever that's just pure Google. So they don't need Motorola to make a phone for them. What they needed was those patents. This is incredibly clear. Patents, patents, patents. Mm-hmm. The president talked yesterday about how he wanted to change patent law to focus on innovation. Google's selling of Motorola for $10 billion less than they bought it for shows that the patent situation is real and problematic for innovation. They're basically saying, we're going to give you, Lenovo, the ability to make phones instead of just computers and tablets so that you can get into this game, but we're going to maintain control of these patents because we need them to fight our competitors, which is an incredibly intelligent move.
Yeah,
it's kind of scary what Google has been doing so far in the end of 2013 and the start of 2014. It makes you really...
It's not scary. It's just wonderful critical thinking.
Yeah, well, it depends which side of the fence you lie on, right?
Lie on the side of the fence that says, I want things to work well.
Well, if you are Apple or any large organization that it directly competes with Google, that's where it's scary. But anyway, I think I'm interested to see where we're at by the end of this year. Like, what do you think? Do you believe that the deals they're having now will have an impact by the end of this year, or do you think this is more like a, 2 year or longer?
I think we're talking about 2 to 5 years out, at least for what we're seeing here with the recent purchases, the robotics companies and the AI companies, and even Nest. Well, Nest we'll see sooner. Nest will see, because they're essentially hands off on Nest. So Nest has their own, path that they're following that will see their roadmap ahead in the next couple of years. But as for the other companies, those will be part of the next Google X project.
Yeah, Nest is definitely interesting. It's like Instagram and Facebook, right? We've seen Instagram move in its own direction. But we've also seen Facebook's influence. There's now Instagram Direct, which is a response to the lack of absorption of Snapchat to Facebook. While Nest has said they will maintain separation from Google and all that, the fact is we all know that the data is going to be shared. And that's something that you have to just balance as a consumer. The situation between convenience or early adoption or whatever, and the fact that Google is going to use that data in order to target you better. It is what it is, and I think that it's one of those things that is part of this march of progress. The thing that would concern me most is not Google. It's the way the NSA is using that data to track you. and I don't mean to bring Edward Snowden back into the mix, but the fact is, this man who, I'm not going to lie, has done some heroic acts, despite the fact that he broke the law in order to do them, is showing us that it's not a question of what you're worried about when it comes to this company or that company. It's a question of like what that company is involuntary sharing with the government.
Yeah, and you saw the recent news that he's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, I did see that news, and I think that that is something we should have talked about earlier on the show. But the fact of the matter is, it's been about 8 months, and we've seen Edward Snowden be able to influence the president of the most powerful nation in the world.
Sure.
And that says something. I mean, if he was just some dude, if he was just some kid looking out for himself, trying to make a buck, it would have been different. But the fact is, he sat back and he said, "Hello, I'm giving up my life for the fact that, you know, for the ability for other Americans to step into this space." And he looked at Bradley Manning and he figured out how to do everything better than Bradley Manning did. And the fact is, his impact, regardless of who he is and what he did, his impact has had a significant effect on freedom in America. So a Peace Prize, you know, especially given the whole the NSA surveilling random people who are our allies, like Germany and so on. Mm-hmm. The Peace Prize seems to make sense. If Obama can get the Peace Prize for just being president, then Edward Snowden can get the Peace Prize for being Edward Snowden. Sure. And frankly, the guy needs the money.
That'd be really interesting sort of twist of circumstance to have Obama get the Peace Prize 1 year and then Edward Snowden to get it.
Obama's already gotten it.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. If Edward Snowden does actually get the Peace Prize.
I just think it's funny that the country who is the most warsome country in the world is up for the Peace Prize twice in 5 years.
On January 24th, Apple Computer will introduce Macintosh. And you'll see why 1984 won't be like 1984.
The original Macintosh turned 30 years old this week on January 24th. And Mac is celebrating the 1984 device that started it all and all the Macs that came after it, both on their site. And the celebrations are occurring throughout the internet. And so I just wanted to ask you guys, you know, when... just tap your nostalgia about your first experiences with a Macintosh computer and how it's affected your life, your lifestyle.
When I grew up, I went to some private schools in New York, and the school that I went to for the duration, the longest duration of my time as a pre-college kid, was the Packer Collegiate Institute, which is now known as a laptop school because it's one of the schools that is focused on using technology to further kids. We had a Mac in every room. I worked on an Apple IIe at the very beginning, and by the time I was in fifth grade, there was a Mac everywhere. Whether it was a Power PC or whatever, there was a Mac everywhere. And when you think of a computer, you think of yourself as like, okay, what does it matter whether it's a Mac or not a Mac, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
One of the big things about this was that Apple kept that brand, the Macintosh. And to this day, the Mac exists. And one of the things that they did with it is that they showed that it's about this ideal that a computer is easy enough to use that you don't need to do this hardcore programming to use it. Every single desktop or laptop that Apple uses is a Mac currently. Lisa is gone.
Yeah.
Apple IIe is gone. Everything is gone but Mac. And, you know, like, I remember when I got to college and the original iMac showed up, these wonderfully colored devices, they seemed useless to a Windows user who had access to games and all this other stuff like that. But over the last 10 years, especially since 2006 when they started integrating the Intel chips, there's simply been no better personal computer. I have an Envy. It's an HP device. I like Windows. I'm a Windows guy, despite the fact that I have an iPhone and a lot of stuff. I'm a Windows dude. But when it comes down to the ability to get things done, you look at the quality of a Mac. And when I look at my HP Envy, they were clearly emulating and copying the Macintosh of that day, 2010. But the durability, the hardware, the fact that they're shipping a device that has, to think about it in automobile terms, everything standard, just shows that, you know, it's good. And when you look at like notebookcheck.com, the international website that grades notebooks, the best Windows machine, the best Windows 8 machine you can buy is a MacBook Pro 15. That just shows you that between the hardware and the software, these guys are doing something right, which explains why they're one of the most profitable companies outside of oil companies in the world. As I look down at my desk, I see an iPhone 4S. I'm holding an iPhone 5. This company had the put it together 30 years ago, when I was 4 years old, to make a product that lasts, and that's an enduring legacy.
Tosin, how about yourself? What's your first experience with Macintosh computer?
Funny enough, my first experience that I really remember are the games. I think it was kind of one of the early ways which I got into games like SimCity, or I think there was one game called 7-Up. Just old school games with the early Macs. And then as that developed more into just utilizing them for work, right? So it starts off as a development in a cycle of play to work, and now it's just this sort of collision where it's my go-to travel device, right? It's the thing that has the best battery life, best power socket. You know, it seems to, in terms of quality, it seems to be right up there with all the other machines, and I think I'm very glad that
I disagree with you on the battery life thing. The iPad kills the Mac on battery life.
Yeah, you know what? What's also really interesting, one of the key things that I will also remember whenever anyone mentions Mac in general is I've seen two people who were diehard PC fans, who hated the concept of Apple, get their hands on Macs and never look back. So,
They look back and they look back and they said, "How did I survive that?" Also, I use a Windows computer and I like it, but I also have a Mac Mini, and even though that device is a server built into my entertainment system and all that stuff, It is fantastic in how it deals with simple things. I can't share from Windows to Windows the way I can share with Windows to Mac. I can't run things on my Apple TV the way I can with the iTunes that refuses to update on my Windows computer. It's a whole mess. And yeah, the Mac is an institution. It's not a computer. It's a hallmark of our cultural tradition as geeks. And I don't mean to sound like some kind of weird Apple fan when I say that. The fact is, again, my main machine is a Windows machine. I own a Chromebook. You know, I've got the street cred around multiple types of devices. But the Mac is an undeniable desktop platform that allows us to get a lot of things done. The fact that I can just tweet by swiping is huge. The fact that they were able to take Mac OS X, which is what it is, Mac OS X, and put it in a mobile device or two mobile devices, the iPhone and the iPad, and make those things destroy the netbook sector, which was booming in 2006, only 8 years ago, and then take over this ability with these create new markets with apps and the ability for software to just kind of be beyond that. So it's fantastic. And there's not a single brand that's lasted for as long. The second brand I can think of that lasted nearly as long, and it's only 15 years, is the Voodoo brand. Voodoo had an Envy device. The Envy device became, you know, purchased by HP, yada, yada, yada. Oh, and sure, now you still have Envy devices. But the Mac is one of the few technology brands that's lasted for basically two generations. So that's significant. It's tight.
I remember the first time. See, I actually remember 1984 and the commercial that aired on during the Super Bowl of 1984, where they announced the Macintosh. And if anyone who's listening has not seen this commercial, just stop right now, go on YouTube and look at Apple 1984 commercial. Probably one of the most famous commercials in advertising history.
It's a commercial that made the Super Bowl bigger than the Super Bowl was.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of those things that makes the Super Bowl even like even more expensive than it used to be.
A terrific piece of marketing, too, because it planted in my mind something that hadn't existed before, and that was the concept that that competing computers, namely IBM, are embody this sort of totalitarian dictatorship that needed to rescuing from.
Andy, how old were you in 1984? Eight? Six?
I don't remember offhand. Let's see.
What year were you born, Andy?
But I was about 14 in 1984. About 14,
you were 15. You were 14 in 1984. So you were thinking about totalitarian dictatorships.
Yeah, yeah, no.
And,
well,
and I just want to put some perspective in here.
It painted a really clear picture, especially for, you know, around that age, in high school, or junior high, you're reading George Orwell's 1984. So, you know, IBM is Big Brother, and we're all drones that need to be released from the shackles of Big Brother, and Apple and this pretty blonde hammer thrower is going to do it. And so
now you're the biggest company on the planet.
Yes.
And it's
ironic how that is sort of turned around, isn't it? People often paint modern Apple as the totalitarian company with their restrictive DRM.
They're young. That's all I got to say.
It wasn't too long after that that a friend of mine got one of the earliest Mac. It was the first Mac, and they were using it in their store for accounting purposes. And I would go over to they owned a little liquor store, and I would go over to the liquor store and hang out, like, literally at any available moment and just play on their Macintosh. And that's when I knew that I eventually wanted to get one of these Macintoshes. But it wasn't until years later when I started editing that I actually had the first sort of hands-on experience with a Macintosh. And by this point, I had already built, and I'm saying hands-on regular daily experience with a Macintosh. Because at this point, I'd built several, like, PC boxes myself.
Windows boxes.
Windows boxes, yes. And so I, on my work day would involve using a Macintosh, though, because that was sort of the standard for a non-linear editing at the time, Avid film composer on the Macintosh. It wouldn't be for years later until Avid came out with a Windows version of that software. So we had to use Macintoshes. And using a Macintosh, like, I would associate a Macintosh with two things. First of all, graphic arts and being very expensive. So for me, a Macintosh was not an option. It was still PC. But eventually, I acquired a hand-me-down blue and white G3, And
oh God, that yeah, was what mentioned these seven.
Remember those?
Yeah, I had one.
And I upgraded the processor in there. You know, I did a sort of a DIY upgrade
with the fold down side, which is remarkable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I used that for a while and I loved it. And since then, my usage, I would use that on occasion, but still use the PC. And then eventually the whole
skip to the future. You now have two Macs in your house and one Windows box.
Yeah. Essentially it's chipped away at my usage so that the only reason I use a PC now at all is for gaming. And it used to be that the PC was my main box and I would use the Mac on occasion for editing or whatever. And now,
well, I'm still a holdout. I still have a Windows machine as my main box.
Oh, really?
Main box. Yes, absolutely.
Well, it won't be long. You'll be with us.
I'll be converted, yeah. I just need the diversity.
Yeah, I mean, I use both. It's sort of half and half. At the office, if I were to get a new machine, it would definitely be a Mac.
Yeah.
My main machine is a Mac, but I mean is a Windows machine. But again, I've got that Mac as my central server in my home. That's huge. You need both. There's just too many. There's too much software available for Windows, and there's too much awesomeness on the Mac OS to just kind of silo yourself into one.
Yeah.
Right. You need something that's going to, you know, especially because Windows talks to Mac now, Mac OS and all these things. You just need to have both. If you're going to be truly exposed to all that's available in technology and geek culture, you need both.
Yep. So Macintosh, 30 years ago to this day, or to this week, the 1984 ad and the unveiling of the first Macintosh. It's been quite a ride with the Apple Computer Company and their Macintoshes, and now they're
Apple Inc. Now,
yeah, Apple Inc. Yeah, and now they're fully ingrained into our culture. Yeah. We're gonna roll right into the video of the week. Our video of the week this week is a recent discovery from the Boston Computer Society. They have recovered and have released Steve Jobs' original 1984 presentation of the Macintosh at the Flint Center near their headquarters in Cupertino. So it's
it wasn't at CES Las Vegas. What the hell?
Yeah. No, this was in a relatively small arena. It's a 90-minute presentation of Steve Jobs just showing the Boston Computer Society how the Macintosh works, selling it for the people. And it's a pretty amazing video, and it's really a throwback to it's like watching the genesis of something amazing.
The modern
something
world.
Yeah. It's like watching the genesis of the modern world. When you see this 90-minute video,
it's like watching World War One,
essentially in color, and narrated by Steve Jobs,
not David Attenborough.
Right. It's over at Time Magazine, and we'll have the link in the show notes. It's worth a look, and there you go. So let's wrap it up here, and I'm going to go around the table here. Start with you, Dwayne. Let me ask you, where can people find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can always hit me up at Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, and you can check me out at flavors.me/DwayneD. Dwayne D is spelled D-W-A-Y-N-E-D. Tosin?
You can catch me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can find my rambling at ircwebcast.blogspot.com. And finally, you can find my R2D2 build process at toastr2d2.tumblr.com.
Yes.
It is a tight R2D2 process.
Yes.
Thank you for putting that up. I read it every day, and I think about making my Cylons.
Awesome. I've got some large updates for this weekend. So
if you're going to make the Cylons, Dwayne, do like the humanoid Cylons, because I'd love to have like a six.
No, I'm not making sexy Cylons. I'm making frightening world takeover Cylons that can run Google's new robotic AI situation. That's my situation. That's my focus.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and Twitter and Facebook also at MrBabyMan. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you get a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. In short, we want to hear from you. So we're here. We want to hear from you. Write us, text us, Twitter us, Facebook us. We just want to hear from you.
Don't stalk us in real life, though.
No.
That's not cool. No. Just online. Just stalk us online.
You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.